This is a special episode of KCUR Central Standard. I'm Alex Smith, and we're on the road in the United Kingdom to see how that nation is dealing with the problem of loneliness. Yes, loneliness. The medical community is starting to recognize loneliness as a major public health threat, both in the UK and back home in Missouri and Kansas. To a lot of people in the U.S., the idea of a government loneliness program might sound like something out of a free-spending European dreamland, like locally sourced organic school lunches in Italy or months of paid paternity leave in Sweden. Might be nice if you don't mind high taxes. But the campaign was introduced by Theresa May, a conservative British prime minister whose government had been scaling back public spending for years. Critics argue that the loneliness crisis may be coming in part because of those cutbacks. To find out more about how communities have been changing, I took a quick train trip west from Manchester to a once quiet city that suddenly became world famous about a half a century ago. There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed. The tourist traps of Liverpool make it almost impossible to forget about this Northwest city's most famous export. Sheila Maitland was growing up here when the Beatles were still just a local band at the start of the 60s. She says that back then, her working-class neighborhood felt like a big family.
If you needed a slice of bread, we'd give you a slice of bread. If you needed a cup of milk, you'd knock next door, go over the road. Everyone in your street was your auntie. Go over to Auntie Mary. We never had much, but we never went short.
Today, Maitland says she feels scared of the world she sees on the nightly news, but she still finds that old Liverpool spirit in a one-of-a-kind center near her home.
Hey. Alex?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, okay?
Hey.
Want a cup of tea?
Sure.
Sounds great. This is Karen.
Hi, Alex.
You're nice.
Hey.
Senior care worker Sue Benson Carson runs the Bridge Community Center in an old Liverpool neighborhood where the town's famous hospitality, humor, and accent are on full display. Within minutes of stepping through the door, guests are welcomed with a cup of tea and an introduction to each and every one of the center's regulars.
Do you hear what he says? You talk like Donny Osmond. Have you met Donny Osmond?
For the record, the answer is no. I've never met 70s teen idol Donny Osmond. But as I found out, meeting Liverpool natives on their home turf means walking in front of a firing squad of hazing that never really lets up.
Is that young Vicky, isn't he?
Yeah,
baby, isn't he?
Maybe you can't see the grey under the light.
So oh, you can get just
good
for
lighting
men.
In here.
You can get just for men, which dyes the hair.
Liverpool is known by most Brits as a textbook underdog. It's mostly a blue-collar place, which has spent years trying to keep up, while bigger, wealthier cities, particularly London, have become even richer thanks to industries like finance. But many Liverpool natives say their situation has gotten worse since the Great Recession. In the aftermath of that crisis, the national government embarked on a long-term program of spending cuts to reduce the deficit. These included cuts to welfare, police, and local governments. Benson Carson started the volunteer-run Bridge Center in response to those cuts. She says many of her neighbors had nowhere else to turn after losing services they had depended on for years.
Them services that were set up have actually failed people, and they're still failing people by closing the doors. So they set all these services up for people with mental health disabilities, able-bodied people, elderly people, and yet they pulled all the funds in. So it's just like, I just don't get it, I don't understand it.
When austerity cuts were introduced in 2010, the UK had a deficit of £144 billion. Mims Davis is a Conservative Member of Parliament, and she's the current Minister for Loneliness. Like many austerity supporters, she says the cuts were difficult but necessary to get the country living within its means.
So none of these were easy, and many communities have, you know, had to take tough decisions. I've been a local councillor, I was in that myself, so I understand that.
Yet austerity opponents say the cuts have gone far beyond acting fiscally responsible. Austerity protests have brought hundreds of thousands of people to march in the streets in recent years. They accuse austerity supporters of using budget worries as an excuse to tear apart a welfare system that's been in place for generations. Maggie O'Carroll heads the women's organization, a Liverpool nonprofit.
We had, you know, universal services. We had a safety net that if things went wrong in your world, you became ill, you became disabled or whatever, that, you know, the whole would look after the few.
Today, critics say that austerity has stripped British neighbourhoods of community cornerstones like senior centres, libraries and safe public spaces, leaving people more isolated. They blame austerity for the steady uptick in poverty over the past 5 years. Liverpool has seen the biggest local government cuts per person of any city in the UK, according to the Centre for Cities, which reports that since austerity began, Liverpool's local government budget has been reduced by nearly a third. It's the equivalent of more than $1,000 per resident. The effects haven't been just economic, according to Dr. Martin McKee. He's a professor of public health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
We've really seen major deterioration in mental health, both in terms of how people describe their health, but also in the extreme manifestation of poor mental health, which is suicide. There has been an increase in suicides, particularly in those areas that have been most badly affected.
Research also shows an increase in deaths among older people, especially among those who've seen their services cut. The National Health Service was technically spared from austerity cuts, but critics say the small funding increases it's received have not been enough to keep up with the population's needs. McKee thinks that's only part of the problem. Like many researchers who've studied health declines in parts of the U.S., he blames many of the problems on hopelessness among people confronting both poverty and an unraveling safety net.
So increasingly what we're seeing is people who are living much more precarious existence on the edge, where they may not know where their income is coming from week to week, for example. And we've picked up how they're more precarious in terms of their employment, the risk of job loss, precariousness of housing.
Many Britons have been troubled to see growing evidence of poverty, like homelessness and church-run food banks, which were once rare in this country. And a recent United Nations report on poverty denounced the government, finding that, quote, great misery had been inflicted unnecessarily. Maggie O'Carroll of the Liverpool nonprofit, the Women's Organization, says the cuts have unraveled the programs and policies that lifted huge segments of the British population out of poverty in the 20th century.
When you look at the British economy, we've reverted back. We're now in Victorian times.
In the fall of 2018, the government announced that austerity was coming to an end, pledging new spending for healthcare, law enforcement, and local governments. And as part of its new loneliness campaign, the government will consider how policy decisions will affect isolation and loneliness. Yet critics say the new budget is still nowhere near pre-austerity spending levels, and they worry that things in the UK will never be the same again. Back at the Bridge Community Centre in Liverpool, the locals take the changes in stride. As they linger over a very British lunch of meat pie, peas, and potatoes, Sue Benson-Carson keeps the hospitality flowing with her attempt to make a visiting American feel at home with her karaoke impression of not the Beatles, but American country singer Patsy Cline.
Like this one song? His love is no longer my own. I was sitting in our house last night singing it. Now they are gone.
5 years after opening, the Bridge Community Center now offers adult education classes, counseling, and benefits assistance, among other services. But Benson Carson says it's still mostly funded by donations. They get no direct government funding and have no plans to seek it. It's not that they couldn't use the money, but Benson Carson says that after years of watching funding cuts cause other programs to collapse, she doesn't trust the government's commitment to help people like those under her watch.
You know, at the end of the day, I'm not one of these that are set up to fail. I'm not going to fail myself, so I'm not going to fail anybody else. You know, I always try my best.
Benson Carson and her regulars take pride in their ability to pull together in hard times, just like Liverpool neighborhoods did 50 or 100 years ago. But the natives say this came about because they had nowhere else to turn in the face of abject poverty. Now, after being stripped of so many of the tools they've come to depend on to fight poverty, it seems that the problem is once again knocking on their door. And that's something no one here is nostalgic for. And in other parts of the country as well, many Brits are taking their own measures in the war on loneliness. After all, nearly every English town and neighborhood already has a secret weapon in the fight. It's something you usually don't see on a tour.
Oh, hello. Where are you both from?
Charlotte, North Carolina, US.
Nice to have you on board. We have an American contingent on board.
In the upstairs of a red double-decker bus, a tour guide points out the highlights of Bath, England. Even in a country famous for charming historical places, this UNESCO World Heritage Site, filled with preserved Georgian buildings, is an architecture nerd's paradise.
And when I shout chandelier, keep looking at the first floor of the building, of that building at the far end there. There are 1.9.
Nearly 4 million tourists come to Bath each year to check out classic British sites like the Roman Baths, Jane Austen's home, and the Bath Abbey. But it's a safe bet that few of them make it outside of the posh tourist areas to visit what may be the most essential British spot of all, the scruffy, dingy, real British pub.
The real British pubs are the ones that you go into and you think, oh, should I be here?
Tom Chapman is a longtime regular of the Bell Inn pub. With its threadbare furniture, layers of old concert posters, and nicked-up bar, it doesn't get much realer than the Bell. As the day's last rays of sun stream in, a handful of older customers lounge near the fireplace, and this 250-year-old establishment feels more like someone's living room than a place of business. It's the dictionary definition of an old man pub. But the Bell is not as old-fashioned as it might look. Hattie Knight Shriver performs in a monthly drag show here. She says it's one of the friendliest places in town.
If you're a nice person, then you're going to be welcome here. And I think a lot of people come to the Bell for the first time and they feel like they've been here for like years and years. And it's because of that community vibe, it's that spirit.
Pubs like the Bell might look timeless, but time has been running out for many of them. More than a quarter of pubs have closed in the UK in the 21st century due to the flagging economy and changing drinking habits. And many other pubs have been taken over by corporations that transform them into gastropub tourist magnets that most locals wouldn't be caught dead in. You know the kind. Gareth Olson is a former Bell bartender who worries about what's been happening in town.
It comes down to kind of like the gentrification kind of thing. But I think in Bath, at least, there are so many independent businesses that have had to close. And therefore, Bath just becomes another city. It becomes another city with the same high street shops, the same restaurants.
A few years ago, the Bell seemed to be under threat. Its owner was ready to retire and got an offer to buy the pub from a big corporation. In a panic, neighbors banded together and pitched an idea to the owner. They proposed buying the pub themselves to be owned by shareholders and run as a collective. This neighborhood in Bath isn't the only community that's worked to save its pub. Kate Stewart is the director of programs for Power to Change, a nonprofit organization based in London that offers guidance to communities that want to buy local pubs.
So I think across England, certainly, which is where we work, we are seeing a rapid decline in the number of assets that are available for the public to meet in as spaces.
Stewart says that in the wake of austerity and the loss of places like community centres or libraries, the pub is the last public place standing in many neighbourhoods and rural areas. Their value in bringing people together goes well beyond the chance to get a drink. The nonprofit has helped 28 community pubs. Stewart says that many of these have expanded beyond watering holes to serve the needs of their neighbors. During the day, some now double as nurseries, soup kitchens, or laundromats.
In the age that we live in, people are much more open to pubs being more than an old boozer for older men to go and sit in. And we want them to become more family spaces, places where everyone feels welcome.
Later in the evening, a line has formed at the Bell Bar, and a dance band is warming up the crowd. And Tom Chapman gives his expert tour of the ales on tap.
So that's a, like a classic, kind of mid-strength English bitter, very nice. Uh-huh. And then this is another.
They're all locally made, and to the confusion of many non-Brits, served lukewarm, or cellar temperature, as Chapman clarifies. That's to keep the yeast alive in this funky, unpasteurized brew. Bar manager Phil Simonshire has been pouring out pints here for years using the big hand pumps, and he's got the forearms of a weightlifter to prove it. He smiles, thinking back on the campaign to save the Bell.
And at that time, you know, people were just coming in and throwing money at me behind the bar. They were like, I can't afford a share, because they were £500 minimum. They went, I can't afford that, but, you know, here's some money to put in to make it stay the same.
It wasn't cheap. Locals had to raise the equivalent of well over $1 million in just a few months to buy the bell. They had some help. Rock god Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin fame pitched in. So did Peter Gabriel. They both have homes nearby, and Plant still stops in from time to time to linger on a bar stool. With a big push, the community was able to raise all the money in just a few months and officially bought the bar in July of 2013. These days, when the bell is packed on a Wednesday night, it's hard to imagine it was ever in danger. At close to 10, the band is deep in the groove, and a handful of dancers crowd to try to find room by the stage. Not far from here, tourists are downing their pints in pristine gastropubs after spending the day gaping at perfectly preserved buildings. But on nights like this at the Bell, as Gareth Olson explains, you see the real Bath. The college students, older people in wheelchairs, construction workers still in work clothes, even families with children munching on pizza, all rubbing elbows in the scruffy pub they decided was worth saving.
If you want a real British pub, you go to a community, because at the end of the day, Britain is made by the characters that we've got in it, and the Bell is very much the same.
The nonprofit Power to Change reports that not one of the once threatened pubs has gone out of business after being taken over by the community. However, as experts work to address loneliness beyond these neighborhoods and across the country, they'll have to reach many more people, including those who don't want to be social.
You get a group of men together, nobody says anything. You put a broken lawnmower in the middle of them, and they'll all attack it to see how it's repaired, and they'll all start talking.
In a minute, pilot projects in the loneliness campaign have shown surprising success, but not everyone's convinced. This is a special edition of KCUR's Central Standard, all about the loneliness crisis. I'm Alex Smith. Stay with me. This is a special edition of KCUR's Central Standard, all about loneliness and the campaign to address the epidemic. I'm Alex Smith, health reporter at KCUR. Earlier this year, I went to the UK to find out what the British can teach us about fixing the problem. If you're not from London, riding the subway here can be a little strange. Take Waterloo Station, one of the busiest underground stations in the country. During rush hour, tens of thousands of people stream in and out, talking and laughing. But after the train doors close, everyone goes quiet. They stare at phones, or books, or off into space. Outside of the occasional whispered remarks between friends, there's nothing to hear but the wheels clacking over the tracks. When Jonathan Dunn moved here from Durango, Colorado a few years back, commuting every day to and from Waterloo Station made him feel kind of lonely.
I think it's interesting for people who don't live in a city to realize how anonymous city living is, because you're surrounded by people all the time that no one sort of pays attention at all.
So Dunn decided to try an experiment. He printed hundreds of buttons that said tube chat, ? An invitation for fellow commuters who might want to talk. He spent a day trying to pass them out, but had almost no takers. So he forgot about it until the next day, when he looked at his phone and found the Twitterverse on fire with British introverts raging at him.
The sort of initial reaction was like, oh, this guileless American like came over and is trying to tell us what to do.
And it didn't stop there. Within days, Dunn was appearing on TV shows, not just in London, but all over the world.
Jonathan Dunn criou broche com os dizeres, papo no metrô.
For some reason, Brazilian people got very interested in this. I was on Brazilian news a lot.
Then the opposition got really aggressive. Commuters on the London Underground started making their own anti-chat buttons and tweeting pictures of themselves wearing them on commutes.
I've got a list of some of the badges that people made in response. I wonder if I could just ask you to read them?
Don't even think about talking to me. Nope. Wake me up if a dog gets on. No chat, please. We're British. Weirdo magnet. Don't effing talk to me.
Despite the haters, Dunn considers TubeChat a success. After all, with a few hundred buttons and a few hours of work, he started an international conversation. And it turns out that at the same time the guileless American was making tight-lipped Londoners foam at the mouth, health experts throughout the country were doing their own experiments to see if Brits could be nudged into sociability.
Back to the woods on trees and the fire in your heart is out. I'm sure.
A street musician plays for lunchgoers in the center of Frome, an artsy town in Somerset County in the hills of western England. Compared to 21st century London, Frome's stone walls and narrow paths look nearly medieval. Almost every one of the town's 26,000 residents is a patient at the Frome Medical Center. And about 6 years ago, the city completed a slick new clinic building on the edge of town. Dr. Helen Kingston has worked in Frome for 25 years. She says opening the new center caused her to think back on her consultations and do some soul-searching about her work.
Some of the conversations you have really help you to see that the help that they need isn't always a tablet or an operation, and the difference that having strong relationships, strong networks of support around someone, even in difficult circumstances, can make to the quality of their lives.
This led the medical center to start its own kind of social prescribing, sort of an early version of what the National Health Service is now creating across the country. The government's loneliness campaign was inspired by a number of experiments and pilot projects that appeared to be promising, and the program in Frome is considered to be one of the country's best examples of how these efforts can work. With the help of volunteers and some government innovation grants, Frome Medical Center made some tweaks to the care it provides. At doctor's offices or in follow-up calls, patients often get recommendations to try clubs or new social activities. A lot of this work happens outside of the clinic, too. Frome and the surrounding area have 900 volunteers who work as community connectors. John Young works as a community connector and takes a soft sell approach, like when he recently invited a neighbor to check out a local program.
And I said to him, well, look, just pop down and see us one Thursday morning. We're in the Welsh Mill Hub and just have a cup of coffee and a cup of tea. I said, I'll be there. You can recognize me. Come and have a chat.
Like the town itself, Frome's community program seems quaint, but observers have been amazed by what a powerful weapon it appears to be in the fight against loneliness and poor health. In the first 5 years of the program, unexpected emergency room visits in Frome dropped by 14%. Many experts see ER visits as a measure of overall community health. During the same time, other towns in the same county, which has been hit hard by austerity, saw emergency room visits increase by almost 30%. Dr. Kingston says that the benefits to Frome went beyond health.
That had cost savings because we were saving more money on admissions than we were investing in the service itself.
In the first 4 years, unplanned emergency room visit costs in Frome dropped by more than a fifth. The Frome study led to some glowing news stories about the power of community.
This is how they do healthcare in Frome. A community working together with each other, and the results are startling.
But not everyone is sure that social prescribing deserves all the credit. Paul Wilson is a health researcher at the University of Manchester.
They offer social prescribing, so that's definitely part of their offer. But I think when you look at the evaluation that's been published, it's far more interesting than that.
Along with social prescribing, the follow-up care that Frome Medical Center has developed includes help like medical planning, home visits, and medication reviews. Wilson thinks Frome's big secret may simply be following up with patients and providing a kind of thorough personal care that few of us actually get from doctors anymore.
When you actually even look at the local evaluations that have been conducted by essentially proponents of programs themselves, there was a real lack of evidence of benefit or indeed of value for money.
despite all the enthusiasm for social prescribing, Wilson says it's not clear that lots of people will actually take the advice to try something like bonsai trimming or tango lessons. The National Health Service acknowledges there are still a lot of questions on how to make loneliness programs work best. But Simon Stevens, who's the head of the NHS, says they've seen enough promising early results to take the campaign national.
We think the evidence that is emerging is good enough to support this rollout of social prescribing for primary care physicians across England, and that's what we're going to be doing over the next couple of years.
But even if the UK hasn't quite landed on the magical formula to get people to try social activities, even skeptics like Paul Wilson agree that the individual pilot projects that inspired the national campaign seem to be accomplishing something special in the communities where they've been taking place, based on what's been seen in community choirs, dance classes, and garden sheds. In a community workshop near the center of the English town of Frome, Tony Hopkins works with a jigsaw. Hopkins is a 78-year-old retired engineer who's lived in the area since the 60s, but he was never big on neighborhood socializing, especially after meeting the love of his life, Glynis, when he was well into middle age.
She was absolutely gorgeous. She was brilliant. The best thing that happened to me in my life. I had to wait 58 years to meet her, but after that, we had a brilliant time.
Tony and Glynis spent the early years of his retirement vacationing in an RV in some of the country's most beautiful spots. When Glynis died 2.5 years ago, Tony was left with a heartbreak that wouldn't go away.
And I'm very lucky in a sense, because if I hadn't have had such a good time with Glyn and she wasn't such a lovely person, I wouldn't feel how I feel.
Looking for a way to fill his time, Tony joined the Frome Men's Shed. Here, a small platoon of mostly retired men take on community projects like rehabbing park benches or building scooter racks for the primary school. Shed organizer John Young is a retired crime scene investigator. He explains that the shed also has the not-so-secret purpose of being a get-together for a demographic group that usually wouldn't go for that sort of thing. He says that unlike many women, who often seem to be more comfortable relating face-to-face, many men do better shoulder-to-shoulder.
You get a group of men together. Nobody says anything. You put a broken lawnmower in the middle of them, and they'll all attack it to see how it's repaired, and they'll all start talking.
Since the shed movement started in the UK about 6 years ago, more than 400 community-organized sheds have sprung up around the country. Surveys have found that participating in sheds reduces depression and increases satisfaction with community and life. Claire Gardner is a researcher at the University of Sheffield who's been trying to find out what makes loneliness projects like sheds work best.
So we found three common features, I suppose, of the most successful interventions.
For starters, these programs have to be designed for specific communities. One size fits all doesn't do it. Second, programs work best when they're actually created and run by the communities themselves.
And that kind of sounds obvious, that you need to involve the people who are going to be using the interventions in the design, but that doesn't necessarily always take place.
Finally, while many different kinds of projects can help people feel less lonely, the biggest effects seem to happen when people are working together with their hands.
Those sort of activities where you're producing something tends to be more successful than more passive activities. So mentioned, it's a really nice example of that, where people come together and they will work together and produce something physical as part of that activity.
Gardner thinks the national campaign has great potential, but not if programs are just dropped in a community's lap. Community members need to be able to do the work for themselves. Still, other experts say it doesn't necessarily take an organized program to start to fix loneliness. Psychologists have found that small, positive interactions with neighbors or even strangers, what they call weak ties, can add up to greater happiness and slow mental decline in older people. Laura Ferguson is the head of the British nonprofit Campaign to End Loneliness. It encourages people to seek out small interactions each day.
I think the beauty of the way that we connect as human beings is that we can find really deep joy in a moment of connection. To nod to someone, smile at someone, talk to someone, exchange a moment with someone, whether they know them or not.
In the town of Frome, the efforts to combat loneliness have now been going strong for more than 6 years. Today, in this small town, many residents take part in several different clubs or activities every week, including the Men's Shed. Remember Tony Hopkins? He recently got help from other Shed members to build a small boat named Glennis in memory of his late partner and their adventures together. Sitting alongside John Young and other Shed members, Tony says the Shed gave him a new start in Frome.
More or less, I come on a Thursday and I've got 30 friends. And I mean friends. John's turned out to be my best friend that I could wish for.
In the coming years, it will become common for doctors and social prescribing specialists in the UK to recommend that patients try social activities. And the government will dole out a lot more money to support individual programs for young people and old people in places like London, Manchester, and Frome. It's likely that many neighborhoods, like the one in Bath, will take their own steps to buy pubs, or like in Liverpool, fund their own community center. In the meantime, health researchers will be watching to see which of these efforts really can make people feel less lonely and possibly even improve health. Meanwhile, back on this side of the pond, the issue of loneliness has started to get some attention. In his first speech in the Senate floor earlier this year, newly elected Republican Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri spoke about the need to address an epidemic of loneliness. New community centers and programs have been opening in rural parts of Kansas. And just this month, Kansas City-based H&R Block pledged $6.5 million to fight loneliness by creating community spaces and encouraging social connections. But these efforts are still small in scale compared to what's happening in the UK, and it's hard to imagine our scattered, profit-driven healthcare system rolling out a nationwide loneliness campaign anytime soon. But as communities in the UK have shown us, we don't have to wait for outside help. We can do a lot to fix the problem on our own. It starts with understanding how serious loneliness is, then making up our minds to reach out to neighbors and strangers, and taking even small steps to make connections or strengthen old ones in the places where we live. Thanks for listening to this special edition of KCUR's Central Standard about loneliness in the United Kingdom and attempts to address it. I'm Alex Smith, health reporter at KCUR. You can read more about all of these initiatives at kcur.org/loneliness. Our stories were edited by Sylvia Maria Gross and Dan Margulies. Support for this project came from the Association of Healthcare Journalists International Health Study Fellowship, funded by the Commonwealth Fund.